It revolutionized transportation in the mid-19th century when George Stephenson proposed that 4 feet, 8.5 inches become Great Britain's standard railway gauge. And its importance in the global economy, despite competing currencies, cannot be overstated, as evidenced by the effects of the Greek debt crisis. We're talking about interoperability. John Palfrey and Urs Gasser, who introduced the world to the concept of the digital native in their 2008 book, Born Digital, have spent the past 5 years collaborating on Interop, a new book project devoted to the practice, promise, and perils of interoperability. Interoperability, a soon-to-be buzzword, describes the quality of certain systems to interact with one another. Using case studies ranging from cell phone chargers to medical records, Palfrey and Gasser illustrate the importance of standardization in solving the next century's greatest challenges. But they also caution that maximum interoperability is not necessarily optimal interoperability. John Palfrey is a professor of law and vice dean for library and information resources at Harvard Law School. He's also the faculty co-director of the Berkman Center. Urs Gasser is the executive director of the Berkman Center, and he teaches at Harvard Law School, at the University of St. Gallen, and Fudan University School of Management. Guest host and author David Weinberger asked Palfrey and Gasser about the process of writing together again and their findings.
When we started out, we were looking really at the straightforward technological question, which is when and how do systems work together to help consumers and to drive innovation and so forth. And I think that's a very important part of the story, but it's only part of the story. So we begin with the technology and data layers. The idea, for instance, when you send an email, it doesn't matter if you're using Microsoft's Outlook or the old-fashioned Eudora or Pine or whatever else, when you type in that message and those little bits get sent across the network, they end up getting rendered in somebody else's system and it works out, even if they're not exactly the same. Those are the technology and data layers. And what we've added, I think, primarily in this book is to look at similar phenomena in what we call the human institutional layer. So by human, we mean the ability of human beings to work together, not just to have the data flow. And in some respects, you could see this most easily through language. In a sense, once you get that email, if you can't actually read it and act on it, then it is great that it's been interoperable to some extent to get those images in the form of the data to you through your email, but it doesn't actually help that much. And I think language is a wonderful question of interoperability, problem of interoperability. We have not agreed all to speak Esperanto, of course, in the world, but we yet find some way to have global commerce and to have global discussions and so forth. So there are ways in which we can have interoperability at this human layer, even without being all the same. And then the institutional level is the most complex, the fourth of the four levels. So there's the technology and the data layers, and then the human and the institutional. And the institutional is where I think we get the most theoretical and where we grapple the most with the hard topic. One way to look at this is legal systems, legal institutions in formal terms, and how they work together. And one of the ways to see this is, for instance, if a couple were to get married in one jurisdiction and get divorced in another, and they each have different kinds of citizenship, how do you make that work if people in this globalized society don't all grow up in the same legal systems? Can we figure out a way to have the system similar enough that they work together? Trade is another really good example of this. So even with different intellectual property regimes in the United States and China, we still can have trade across these two regimes. They're similar enough that we can make the contracts work and so forth. So those are the ideas of technology and data on the one hand, and human institutional levels of interoperability. And often, you have to get all of those four right in order to have the transaction or the interaction work well.
So we don't all speak Esperanto. And if we did, we wouldn't be talking about interoperability of language. The concept wouldn't make a lot of sense. Is interoperability important because we simply are not all going to, well, speak Esperanto or have exactly the same laws? Or is it also important because there's strength in not all having the same language, the same laws, the same culture, the same, et cetera?
Absolutely. I think one of the beautiful things about interop is indeed that it is a third way. On the one hand side, you know, we can live in a very diverse or we are also living in a diverse world. But of course, we want to make sure that we can collaborate, that we can work together, that we can do commerce and trade together and, you know, live a meaningful life, so that the diversity doesn't end up kind of being a fragmentation ultimately, where you have silos of cultures and knowledge and so forth. And on the other end of the spectrum, there would be uniformity. The language example is illustrative, of course. If everyone would speak the same language, we would lose a lot in terms of cultural diversity and richness and so forth. And Interop is in a way a middle ground. It provides a way to make systems work together, to share information. Sometimes we need to develop hacks to make that possible. Translation is such a technique that evolved over time when we translate books and texts and so forth to make them understandable. Of course, learning a foreign language is another way to increase your own human interoperability. It's a possible approach to preserve a certain degree of diversity within the ecosystem, which obviously is key, as for instance, research on biological system teach us, right? We need to take care, I think, and be mindful not to end up in a situation where we have too much uniformity across systems, because that increases also the risks of system failure. If we bet everything on one technology, for instance, this may create real problems. So redundancies and diversity are important features of systems, and Interop preserves them in the way we understand it. Now there are competing theories, but I think that's where we ended up.
And yet, to use one of your many really wonderful case studies, yet we all want to be able to plug our cell phones into the same plug for charging it, and we can't. So why can't we do that yet? That's not a technology challenge, right? I mean, we know how to get a standardized plug. Why can't we do that yet?
I think that's a market challenge, in the sense that there are companies that seem to think they can make more money by virtue of making you buy more chargers over time. And we've been reluctant, I think, in a free market environment to force everybody to use the same cell phone charger. This is a really good example of how consumers can be aligned completely in terms of their interest in having something be the same and simple. USB is a really good example of this, a wonderful technology that allows you to have many things be uniform that don't need to be diverse. And yet when companies see it in their interest not to make it standardized, that they can do so. I think we liked very much the approach that the European Union took in the case of cell phone chargers. And that was really by using what we think of as the sword of Damocles regulation approach. It was to say that the state, the European Union in this case, made it clear that they were going to regulate if the companies didn't get their act together. And lo and behold, if those big companies didn't come together and say we're going to have a uniform way to do a cell phone charger, and you know that's going to help the environment, it's going to help consumers, and isn't this great, that was clear that a little bit of pressure from the state to say we're going to intervene in this way ended up working. And we haven't done that in the United States, so we actually have lots of wasted power cords out there. And I think this is a really good example where sometimes the market doesn't work in favor of consumers and in favor of interoperability, in this case also in favor of the environment.
And in this case, the European Union didn't specify which plug was going to be used, but allowed the market to work that out?
That's right. I think one of the subtleties that we underline in this book is that very often the state is not in the best position to choose a technology. So I don't think we would be in favor of standardization or interoperability approaches where the state was in the position to pick winners and losers throughout the technology landscape. I think that would be a mistake. On the other hand, it is equally a mistake sometimes for the state to be completely out of the picture from a regulatory standpoint. And of course, the state is never completely out of the picture. They're setting the background rules against which people are competing and so forth. So I think finding this balance is hard. And frankly, as some people read this book, they may find it to be unsatisfying in a way, unsatisfying that it's not saying, this is how to do it, exactly. And that's part of the problem with Interop. There is no one solution that always works, and very often it's a collaboration between the public and the private that's going to work out in these complex situations.
You raise the issue of suboptimal standardization as one of the occasional outcomes things interoperate, but at using a standard that is just not what would we would like. And in particular, you talk about intellectual property rules along these lines. Can you explain the way in which IP is perhaps suboptimally standardized?
The relation between interop and IP is one of the most complex topics, in my view, that we covered in the book, and by no means in a way that is doing justice to it in all nuances. On the one hand side, IP actually is an enabling strategy to create more interoperability. Take the example of a hardware manufacturer actually working together with a software company using licensing to run certain software on, on a laptop computer, right? Or two companies collaborating with each other using their respective IP assets to create a new product or service. So we see that sort of collaboration among companies, of course, all the time, where IP is an enabling force behind it through licensing of IP rights. So IP in these instances actually enables interoperability. But then sometimes you see also, of course, the opposite. So the relationship is bidirectional, that actually the use of IP hinders higher levels of interoperability. Sometimes this kind of negative relation is based on the way that governments set the rules, the IP rules themselves. One example in this category is the protection, the anti-circumvention provisions, that is the protection of digital rights management systems through means of law, as we know it here in the US, but also in Europe and other parts of the world, where actually the law prohibits, for instance, certain forms of reverse engineering or certain ways to make your device or DVD player interoperable with a DVD that you bought in a different country with a different region code, right? But then there is a second category of cases where actually it's not about the ways necessarily how the government set the IP rules, but how the rules are exercised by the companies, how they use their IP rights, whether they use it or not, and to what degree. And so that's maybe something John wants to comment on, since he wrote a book on IP strategy specifically. And this comes certainly up in the patent space quite a bit, where we see a lot of strategic behavior, how patents are used to block certain innovations from competitors, which can be read as a way to exercise IP to hinder interoperability.
So surprising and really good things about the book is that it's very balanced. So you talk throughout about finding the optimal level of interoperability, which implies that full out maximal is not always the optimal level. And so one of the perils that you point to throughout is that interoperability can lock us into technologies. Can you give us an example of that?
I think the best example of lock-in of a certain level of interoperability is air traffic control. Take the idea that you had relatively small number of flights after the Wright brothers invent air travel, and over time, as many more people start flying, you need a mode to ensure that these planes don't crash into one another. And a series of different approaches evolve over time. Some of them are rules, legal rules. Some of them are technologies and so forth. And a system gets developed that countries all around the world buy into and get locked into, in a way. It's highly interoperable, but it's not necessarily perfect. And one way to see that is it hasn't changed much over the last several decades. And to their credit, members of the Obama administration have looked into how might you improve the air traffic control. For instance, the use of GPS in air traffic control. It's sort of amazing that we use GPS as a way to get around in our cars, but we don't use it as a core part of the air traffic control system. And part of the story is that we got locked in to a certain level of interop a few decades ago, and it's been very hard to undo that locked-in setting. So I think that gives an example where it may be good enough in many cases, good enough not to have disasters all the time, but it's not optimal. And I think that goes to your previous question about IP as well. The fact that we may get to a harmonized intellectual property regime may mean that we're getting to too high a level of protection across the world. That doesn't mean the interoperability is right. It means it's highly interoperable. And I think figuring out how we don't just go for maximal interop all the time, or that we don't do something that is expeditious, we get to the expedient, we get to the place where we need to get, but then don't have the ability to adjust over time, that's one of the big problems. And we don't have a simple answer to that, but rather to say it's important to build institutions that can be flexible enough to tweak it over time and to get to something closer to optimal.
The air traffic control example is actually a really good example of the multiple layers of why you need to look at more than just the software layer, the technology layer. You write about the evolution of the use of language as a key element of interop for air traffic control.
Yes, that's correct. I mean, that's a fascinating story. It starts, of course, with natural human language that was used as soon as radio communication was available among, you know, pilots and air traffic controllers. And that created lots of misunderstandings over time. So there was a need actually to standardize the language that is used in these communications. And so in the next phase, essentially, a standard form of talking to each other over radio developed. That was kind of the first phase of standardization. But still, French aircraft pilot would use French, standardized French version of French language, as opposed to, you know, his U.S. colleague who would use the standardized version of English for these purposes. And then in the third and most recent stage of evolution, we see a harmonization internationally at the international level, where we all now use this particular form of standardized English as the base language among air traffic controllers and pilots. And this particular narrative is a fascinating one on multiple levels, but certainly also because you see how actually quite early on an interoperability challenge was recognized, but also how long it takes actually to develop an interoperable system and how hard it is to maintain it over time and also to make it a kind of a global interoperable solution. So we have to be very patient, and as John mentioned earlier on, there are often not simple silver bullet solutions to a particular interop challenge.
In a case like that, you're facing not just technology decisions, but political and cultural decisions about language. So that must make it much, much harder. Towards the end of Interop, the book, you have two extended examples, both taking really hard cases of. So I was wondering if you could take us through each of those. And one of them is the electronic health records.
So electronic health records are, I think, the hardest single case that we came across, because they present a series of challenges at all those layers we talked about. And it's also a puzzle why, with a lot of political will, we haven't been able to get it done in almost any culture other than really some quite small states that have been able to do a kind of command and control approach to electronic health records. So in the United States and Britain, in other big countries, there's been a goal of improving healthcare by virtue of having electronic health records that can be shared across multiple providers. It's a very simple idea, right? Which is, you get hurt in one jurisdiction that doesn't have to happen to be where you ordinarily get your medical care, and very simply, somebody can access through the cloud or web or otherwise the information about your allergies and what you can be treated with and so forth and your previous health situation. This seems like a very simple idea. It's also the subject, as many studies have shown, of the approach that may wring a lot of the cost out of this very ineffective healthcare system that we have today. And yet we can't get there. And it's a problem that is mostly political, I think. It's mostly about the inability to force those who have legacy systems to break out of their siloed approach and to break out of their particular market approach and to work together in a fashion. And I think this is a case, the health records case, where we need more government intervention, not less. And I think the Obama administration, just as one example, is on the right track in terms of nudging forward in this way. But in order to get to where President Obama has said we need to get by 2014, they're going to have to be much more aggressive than they are right now. And I think that's a very substantial challenge. And it's not to say it isn't a technical challenge. There are technical challenges of figuring this out. But I think that there is much more about whether or not we're going to push the market forward in favor of highly interoperable systems with respect to healthcare in the name of saving cost and saving lives and so forth.
Maybe I might just add something to that. I, of course, agree with everything you said. However, I wouldn't underemphasize the complexity of the system itself. It seems to me that's another hugely, hugely complex area. Where you have many actors with different incentives, take hospitals who made investments in their technological systems, in their into their IT infrastructure. You have providers of such infrastructures who have vested interests, of course. And you may also have different incentives as far as information sharing is concerned among the people working in these institutions. It turns out, for instance, that not everyone is excited on the caregiving side that actually his or her file can be accessed and double-checked and that you can have second opinions easily, whether asked or unsolicited. On what your service has been that you provided, right? So there are liability issues involved and so forth. Of course, there are also privacy concerns that are actually quite hard to address. So altogether, I would argue it is a complex systems problem that we have to overcome. And that I would just add that to the description of the situation. But I would also agree, of course, that dealing with such complex systems, sometimes you have to resort back to powerful mechanisms, which is, in this case, most likely, if you want to succeed, a stronger government involvement, where you also decide and make, you know, forced decisions, at least, with regard to certain standards that should be implemented by these various players who can't agree on their common standard.
And how do we make knowledge interoperable?
Well, David, of course, you are the great expert on this topic in the room, and I think this is a place where our work actually intersects fairly substantially. The interoperability case that we take up in this book with respect to knowledge is really about the preservation of knowledge, and it's a very simple problem, which is that in the analog era, when we have physical objects that are the way in which we store knowledge, it's relatively straightforward to preserve them. You use climate control, for instance, and you use acid-free paper, and you take great care with things that have enormous value, and you have redundant copies and so forth, and you know that these will last for thousands of years, most likely if you handle it correctly. Anyway, hundreds of years in most cases. In the digital era, while there's something wonderful about the fact that we can share information so quickly and digitize it and use it in its multiple forms, the lifespan of digital information is actually extremely short, and there's a fair amount of digital information from the 60s and 70s, for instance, that we probably lost forever. I think we all can relate to the idea of having 3.5-inch floppy disks and 5.25-inch floppy disks and, you know, probably the USB sticks that we have right now, which are just not going to be all that useful, much less useful certainly than a printout of the same information in a few years. And we've got to figure out how over time we preserve knowledge if we're going to be relying on the digital format as a matter of preservation. And we see this as an interop challenge, in part as an example of interoperability needing to take place over time, as opposed to interoperability just at one moment. And Wirth invoked the notion of complex systems, which is exactly right. This is a classic example of a complex system where there are multiple actors and a large number of different competing, often, incentives, and you need to get a lot of people to act in concert to get over collective action problems. And to me, part of it is for us all to collaborate in various ways. You and I, David, have been working on the Digital Public Library of America, and in some respects, I think that's an example of how we can address some of these issues. If, as we digitize historic knowledge or current knowledge, if we work together using open standards, open systems, open APIs, and so forth, and we pool our resources, we're going to have a much better chance to update these materials over time. I think if we don't do that, if we don't collaborate, and if libraries, for instance, or other cultural heritage institutions stand alone over time, there's going to be a much greater challenge to do this updating or kind of future making of the material. We'll have to do it in such a complex and varied way that I think we're going to lose a fair amount of knowledge that's very important. So I think this is a story about collective action, and it may be that we need, again, to have a stronger role by the state or by somebody saying it's important for you to commit to preserving knowledge in certain formats so that we'll be able to have that over a longer period of time than, say, 5 or 10 years, the average lifespan for a particular document format today.
You actually point to the National Archives and David Perio, the archivist, as potentially taking a lead role in this.
I think David Perio and what he's done at the archives is a fantastic example of a government actor stepping up and saying, we recognize what's going on in the digital age and we want to be a leader in this. I couldn't agree more with the approach that he is taking to this problem. I think more of us just need to follow that particular lead and other government actors to step up to the same challenge.
So each of you are incredibly busy people. How did you interoperate on this book? How did you write this book together?
Well, I think it starts with a commitment to do it, and then we have our own ways to carve out times. It changed, of course, from over the years. Now I think we both write early in the morning, and for the previous book, we both wrote that late in the night.
Born digital.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, we draft chapters according to a game plan we developed, and exchange the chapters and edit and review and so forth. So.
And you come out as friends on the other side.
You know what? It's so much more fun to do with worse than to write on my own, at least in my own experience. And I think one of the things that happens with these book projects is they evolve over a number of years. So in both the case of Born Digital and Interop, these are 5 or 6 years projects that overlap with lots of other things. So this started with some papers we wrote in 2007, 2008, with a team of people who have helped us with the case studies, and the web has got a series of 8 or 10 case studies that build out this case. So we actually have thought about this book as a project first, and then the book as one of the instantiations of it, but you can go online and see work by lots of students and fellows and researchers and friends that extends and make this case much more broadly. And so as part of that project and over a number of years, I think we've learned a lot together, and I know certainly that my work gets much better when it goes through through the ringer that Ors puts it through, and it's much more fun.
Thank you very much.
Thank you guys.
John Palfrey is a professor of law and vice dean for library and information resources at Harvard Law School. He's also the faculty co-director of the Berkman Center. Urs Gasser is the Berkman Center's executive director. He also teaches at Harvard Law, the University of St. Gallen, and Fudan University School of Management. Special thanks to our guest host, David Weinberger. And today's episode of Radio Berkman was produced by Dan Jones and me, Frances Harlow, at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society in Cambridge, Massachusetts. For more episodes or information, go to cyber.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. You can also like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter.